Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. Vedic by KJ Heritage. The dead don't always die. Top company scientist Chin Jelinek has committed suicide. Vedic, a half-alive empath with no memory of who or what he is, will die in 6 hours if he can't find out why, or so the company tells him, an added incentive to get the job done. Our hero soon discovers he is one of the skilled, a genetically enhanced human revered and despised in equal measure, a bloodhound with a terrifying past who'll stop at nothing in his pursuit of the truth. And the skilled always get their guy, don't they? Vedic, number one, by KJ Heritage, on sale now. There's a link to it in the show notes. KJ Heritage's uncanny sense of pacing and story puts him at the forefront of today's speculative fiction writers. Gritty, intense, and compelling, Vedic is something you don't run into often enough in sci-fi, a cerebral thrill ride you don't want to end. Prepare to lose sleep reading Vedic, delicious science fiction. That's what other people are saying about it. Find out for yourself. Vedic, the first book in the series by KJ Heritage. Jasper T. Scott. His box set Dark Space, the complete series. This is 6 books bundled together on sale now for 99 cents. 6 complete books, over 600,000 copies sold. More than 2,000 pages of epic space opera for the low price of 99 cents. Also available in Kindle Unlimited if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber. Humanity is defeated. 10 years ago, the Scythians invaded the galaxy with one goal, to wipe out the human race. Now the survivors are hiding in the last human sector of the galaxy, Dark Space, once a place of exile for criminals, now the last refuge of mankind. The once galaxy-spanning Imperium of Star Systems is left guarding the gate, which is the only way in or out of Dark Space, but not everyone is satisfied with their governance. Freelancer and ex-convict Ethan Ortain is on the run. He owes crime lord Alec Barandi 10,000 souls, and his ship is badly damaged. When Barandi catches up with him, he makes an offer Ethan can't refuse. Ethan must infiltrate and sabotage the Valiant, the Imperial Star System's fleet carrier which stands guarding the entrance of Dark Space, and then his debt will be cleared. While Ethan is still undecided about what he'll do, he realizes that the Imperium has been lying and putting all of Dark Space at risk. Now Brondi's plan is starting to look like a necessary evil, but before Ethan can act on it, he discovers that the real plan was much more sinister than what he was told, and he will be lucky to escape the Valiant alive. Grab all 6 books for 99 cents right now. Dark Space, the complete series by Jasper T. Scott. The Unwelcome Trilogy by R.D. Brady. Survivor, Mother, Leader, and Humanity's Last Chance. Deep within the remnants of the United States, Lila Richards oversees a camp of 200 survivors. In a world where living is an everyday struggle, and only through banding together can people survive, the arrival of the Unwelcome only made her job harder. Riley Quinn and Miles Jones have been raised by Lila for the last 5 years. They're also one of the Cursed, the children between the ages of 13 and 18, whom the Unwelcome kill on sight. No questions, no pleas, just death. Protecting one another and the people of their camp is ingrained in all of them, but now each of them faces increased danger as the reason why the Cursed have been targeted by the Unwelcome slowly comes to light, and that truth will shock them to their core. Now time is running out, not just for the Cursed who are being hunted down by the Unwelcome, not just for Lila and her family who will face the greatest challenge yet, but for all of humanity. The world changed radically 35 years ago, but today humanity's very existence is on the line, and the fight has begun that will ensure its future or its annihilation. Fans of A.G. Riddle, James Rollins, Suzanne Collins, and Brandon Sanderson will love the Unwelcome Trilogy. Pick up your copy of the Unwelcome Trilogy on Amazon today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Olivia Hawker on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book. It's called One for the Blackbird, One for the Crow. This is such a stunningly beautiful novel, Olivia. I am super excited to have you on the show. We were just talking before we started writing, and I kept having this nagging feeling that I knew this author all along. And last week, I realized that Olivia Hawker is Libby Hawker, who you've been on the show before, and I'm a huge fan of your historical fantasy novels, and that amazing book that you wrote a couple of years ago, Take Off Your Pants, which, you know, has changed so many writers' lives. So welcome back to the show, and welcome Olivia for the first time.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be back with you. I think about your show often and listen as frequently as I'm able to. So it's great to be back. And yeah, here I am under my other disguise.
So funny. You know, I mentioned your historical fantasy series that I absolutely love. The first time we talked, we talked all about those, and you know, that my daughters love those books, and it was something that we read together. And then you had this great book about, you know, transforming yourself from being a pantser to more of a plotter. And, you know, I've heard from so many people that book, Take Off Your Pants, has really changed the way they view the creative process. But now we've got this book that is so different from the stuff that you've done in the past. What was where did this book come from, One for the Blackbird and One for the Crow?
Yeah, this book is one I wrote for my traditional publisher, Lake Union Publishing, and I had a book come out from them called The Ragged Edge of Night last year. It is a World War II novel, and we were trying to figure out what would be the best book to follow that one with. And we knew we wanted to go kind of keep the general tone of The Ragged Edge of Night, which is not to say we wanted it to be like about war or anything like that. But we wanted to have the sort of like deep introspective perspective from the characters, where it's really like way, way inside a character's head. So we discussed that a little bit. And also I kind of thought for a while about what kind of story I wanted to tell for the book that would follow Ragged Edge. And I realized I really wanted to talk about death, not in like a scary or menacing way, but in a way that made people maybe hopefully feel more comfortable with the fact of death. So that's how One for the Blackbird, One for the Crow sort of got started, once I realized that I wanted to touch on death a little bit for my next book. The story kind of started to put itself together in my head. And I was actually able to pull a little bit from, loosely from an actual family story that involved the death of a family member in order to create it. So, yeah.
So Wyoming 1876 is the backdrop to tell the story about death. Why there and why these characters?
Well, there, because that was where the family members who I loosely based this story on were living at the time. They were homesteaders out in Wyoming. They were actually nearer to Buffalo. I set the book kind of on the other side of the Bighorn Basin from where it really took place, near the town of Paint Rock instead of Buffalo. But they were homesteaders who lived out on the frontier. They were sheep ranchers. And that was the setting I wanted to work with. I wanted to stick as close as I could to my real ancestors' setting and sort of world that they knew while I told this story. So I used the authentic setting. It was really fun to research, too, because I got to find all these cool old pictures of them, like in front of their sod brick house and everything. So it was really fun to do the research for that book.
Your other series that I've alluded to a little bit takes place in ancient Egypt. And how different is it shifting gears to these vastly different settings?
It's definitely, you really have to think differently about the way you convey the setting. Because, you know, when you're working with something like ancient history, I think the readers expect it to be grander and more of like a set piece. You know, they want this to be like big and in your face, and they want a lot of details of like what everything looked like, what kind of food people ate back then, what they were doing. It's not as thrilling. The setting is not as big, I suppose you would say, in a more recent historical novel. So especially like the one I previously wrote, which was World War II. I mean, middle of the 20th century setting, other than the fact that it's during a war, is not as like, just, I'm not beating the reader over the head with it, I guess you'd say. And the same was true for doing something in the late 19th century, like Blackbird. It's definitely there. In fact, I've actually had, we have a promotional opportunity coming up with my publisher, and for that, they want me to write an essay about creating vivid settings, because I guess whoever, you know, read the book for that particular promotion was like, oh my God, the setting in Blackbird is amazing. I want to know more about it. I feel like, you know, having come from all these ancient history books I've done where the setting is like so over the top, I feel like it's so subtle in Blackbird. I was like, okay, I mean, I'll write about big crazy settings if you want, but I don't know how big and crazy it is in there compared to like ancient books. It's like really in your face.
Well, you know, Wyoming 19th century is foreign to a lot of us. I mean, and it does have a certain grandeur to it. Maybe it's more subtle, but yeah, I mean, I think there are some of those elements that you pull from here as well.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I grew up in rural Idaho, which, let's be honest, is basically the same as Wyoming. So maybe to me, like, it just feels like normal, you know, like, yeah, of course, I'm going to describe all these mountain ranges and plains and the way the rain comes in and blurs the horizon and stuff, because, like, that's just normal. So I don't know, maybe I'm biased in my perspective as an Idaho girl, but, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, you know, one of the immediate things and something that, you know, embarrassingly tripped me up is the name change. Your Lake Union books you publish as Olivia. I know you as Libby. Mm-hmm. What was the thought process on changing names? And let me just preface, say, I think a lot of writers have a lot of vast differences in taste and would love to write something completely different than what they're known for. So how scary is that, you know, to get outside of what you're known for and do something different? And is that why you chose the different pen name?
Yeah, in a sense, it's a bit of a kind of a tangly story, I suppose. So I have published some stuff with Lake Union as Libby Hawker in the past. But what we decided to do before we launched The Ragged Edge of Night was we wanted to set it apart from my previous work a little bit and sort of develop a totally new brand, really, for Lake Union that focused more on what we call upmarket fiction, which kind of like walks the line right between commercial fiction and literary fiction. It's like right on that weird borderland in between. It's like the type of book that like book clubs would be really into, you know, that sort of thing. So they wanted to really like rebrand me and push me in a more upmarket direction, which I was thrilled with, because I mean, I will write commercial historical fiction set in ancient Egypt or wherever else until I keel over dead and do it happily. It's fine. I enjoy it. But I really feel I really shine as a writer when I'm allowed to do more upmarket work, which is harder to sell as an indie author. You know, like I've self-published some stuff as Libby Hawker that's more on the upmarket scale, and it doesn't sell that well. It's not really what the crowd that buys self-published historical fiction is looking for, you know? So I have been so thrilled that my publisher saw my strengths as an upmarket and literary writer and came up with this plan to kind of rebrand me with this new identity that would allow me to do books that were really dramatically different in tone. So if you read like Mercer Girls is one of the books I did as Libby Hawker for Lake Union Publishing, it feels very different in tone from Blackbird or Ragged Edge of Night. It's still a good book. You're still going to have fun reading it. You know, the story's still good and everything, but there's a noticeable shift in style. So the Olivia Hawker books really allow me to get more kind of stylistic and artistic with my work, which I love doing. I'm so stoked about it. So, yeah, really happy with my publisher's decision to do that. Yay.
You bring up a great point. When we start thinking about the differences in indie publishing and trad publishing or hybrid publishing, which we're seeing more and more of, that we tend to think of that from the writer slash publisher's perspective. What we don't think a lot of is from the reader's perspective. You're saying that there's a market shift in the people that tend to buy more indie published works and people that are looking at more trad published works. Can you explain how that works, or maybe what you've learned about the market from kind of having feet in both bodies of water?
Yeah, and take this with a grain of salt too, because I'm talking purely about the historical fiction market, which is different from what a lot of the other genres are doing right now. It may be the case that other genres, there's really no distinction between, you know, whether readers are willing to buy self-published versus traditionally published work. But it's still the case in historical fiction, like that reading audience is still kind of adopting indie publishing, and a lot of the readers aren't even aware that that like people are out there self-publishing historical novels that they might enjoy. It's still an audience that is very much tied into like bookstore distribution. They very much prefer print over ebook still, which is like shocking compared to, you know, like romance readers, for example, will just gobble up ebooks and you know, they are not as keen on buying print books. But it's really the reverse in historical fiction, where we're, you know, like I always like to joke, it's not surprising that we're like 15 years behind the rest of the publishing market, because we are obsessed with the past. So so we're kind of living in the past in historical fiction, and it's just taking a long time for that audience to even like understand that you can use Amazon algorithms like the also bots to discover other authors. You know, they're very much like, I'm going to go to my Barnes & Noble store and see what's on the co-op tables there, and that's what I'm going to buy and read. Maybe they'll listen to some word of mouth recommendations from their friends. But yeah, that makes it much trickier to find your audience and reach them in upmarket historical fiction. It's just like, it's a big and potentially very lucrative audience, but it's really difficult to reach effectively right now as a self-publisher, simply because, yeah, they're just so like, they love to go to bookstores, which God bless bookstores. I love them too. But yeah, they're not using the same discoverability tools that readers are using in other genres. So it's challenging. It's very challenging.
When we start talking about this idea of upmarket historical fiction, the ideas of literary fiction versus genre fiction, I think, trip up a lot of people. They don't quite exactly know what those differences are. What makes something literary? What makes something more genre oriented? And then we start talking about another differentiation, which is somewhere in the middle between those two, in upmarket fiction. As a writer, not as a publisher marketer, but as a writer, and I know that you plan this out ahead of time, because we've read Take Off Your Pants, and we know that you approach this as a professional, and you talked about you know, talking with your agent and deciding what to do next. So this is intentional for you. How do you hit that zone that is between the two, and what things are you looking for as a writer to make sure that you weave into the story so that you're going to hit these tones that people are expecting?
Yeah. Ooh, great question. No one's ever asked me that question before, and I love it. First of all, let me, as briefly as I can, try to kind of define what I mean between when I'm talking about literary and commercial fiction. It's a definition that shifts a lot depending on who you ask. So my definition is a commercial book is tightly focused on pace, and the characters tend to fit expected archetypes very closely, right? So you've got heroic characters and villains, and it's a relatively unchallenging situation from like an emotional or ethical point of view in that story. You're, you know, whatever conflicts your characters are facing, it's usually pretty obvious who's on the good guy side and who's on the bad guy side. It's an accessible read that somebody would want to take on vacation with them to just relax and have a good time. Okay, so that's what I mean when I talk about commercial historical fiction. And then when you talk about literary fiction or even something that's really on the that extreme of the upmarket scale, you're talking, although pace I think should still be important in any good book, the focus is less on like forcing the reader to turn pages as rapidly as possible and more on sort of drawing them into an introspective state and making them think and feel things, instead of just kind of going along on this fun ride. So that's what I'm talking about with literary versus commercial. Okay, and then refresh me on the rest of your question.
I was so absorbed in your answer. What was my so as someone who plans ahead, like I know that you do, how do you approach the planning phase to make sure that you're in the zone and hitting the correct tones for that book that you need to?
Right. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, so what I do in order to sort of hit that upmarket note that's like in between my definition of literary and commercial is I make sure I pay close attention to the pacing of the book, which I go into in Take Off Your Pants, the thing with the triangles. Like anybody who's read Take Off Your Pants remembers the triangles thing. And if you haven't, you can buy it and read it.
I'll put a link to it in the show notes of this episode for sure.
So I make sure, even though literary fiction isn't necessarily focused on pace, I make sure that I put a strong emphasis on those pacing elements so that I bring that aspect of kind of page-turning urgency into what would otherwise be a literary novel to kind of strike that balance between the commercial and the literary. So in an upmarket book like Blackbird, I've got characters that are really thinking a lot about what's going on inside of them. It's very much a personal journey for each one of them. And I'm attempting with my prose and sort of the imagery I'm using to make the reader think and feel a lot more than they are just, "Wee, I'm having fun on this ride." But I also bring in the "wee" ride part with that pacing that just keeps introducing more and more stakes to the readers and or to the characters and pushing them farther and faster along that that character arc. So that's how I plan it.
It seems to me that more literary stories are very emotion driven and would probably lend themselves to more of a pantser method because the writer is kind of discovering how these characters are feeling about things as they go. And that seems to me that it would definitely fit with a more organic writing process than outlining and planning ahead of time, because that tends to, just by its nature, you're outlining kind of how the plot's moving forward and how you're steering the reader as you go. How do you leave room to let these characters organically, feel things? Because one for the Blackbird, one for the Crow is, it's heart-wrenching in places. And you kind of get the feeling that you as the writer are discovering things about these people as you go. It just has that kind of weight to it. How do you balance those things when you're writing a book like this?
Oh, man, that's a good question, too. I don't know if I had a specific process for that. I mean, I have the socially acceptable answer I can give you, which my publicist would probably prefer, and the 100% honest answer I can give you. I'll see if I can walk a line somewhere in between. I relied on inspiration a lot for that, which is not like a helpful answer for other authors listening to this podcast. I'm sorry. a lot of it was just me thinking a lot about who these characters were, the situation they were in, and what would be reasonable for a person like that to feel and experience in that scenario. Like how would they react? You know, I did a lot of putting myself into, you know, mentally putting myself into their situations and just, you know, what would I feel in that scenario and just putting that in there. So in a large way, like all four of the characters in Blackbird are just kind of parts of myself, you know, just just me imagining what I would, if I were Nettie Mae and I were angry at the world all the time, and then this happened to me, how would I feel? If I were Cora and I felt, you know, an incredible amount of shame all the time, and then this happened, how would I feel? You know, it was mainly that. And then the less socially acceptable answer is, I smoked a lot of weed while I was writing this book. And I just kind of went with it, with whatever came to me while I was in that state. I was like, okay, jotting down notes. I do that not infrequently with my writing, I will admit. And sometimes it works out great and sometimes it doesn't. So use it your own risk, other writers.
Let the record show that episode 740 of Author Stories has the most honest answer ever given. That's fantastic.
There is actually a more honest answer I can give you, which I won't. We'll just leave it at that for now.
I love it. I love it so much. So we begin this book with this sort of high nebulous idea of wanting to explore death. And what does death mean? How does death affect us? And what is, you know, is death the ultimate answer? And then we come down from there to you anchoring this to some family stories that have been passed down, and this personal connection you have with this particular place and time and story. Kind of walk us through making that connection, if you would. How did you go from this big idea to then finding something that you personally could connect with, and then how the story starts unfolding from there?
Yeah. Well, I will say that this particular story from my family history about these two homesteading families that where the women ended up without their men and ended up having to work together to survive, even though they hated each other's guts. That's kind of been just in that vague description, in that vague way, for many years. It's just been something that I always kind of planned to write about someday, but I had never really fleshed it out beyond that, or like figured out the thematic elements of it. Like, so for example, of course, the theme of Blackbird Now is death. But I didn't have any thematic ideas. It was just sort of like, it'd be cool to write about my great grandparents and how they had that whole crazy thing happen to their families a while ago. But I was wrapping up The Ragged Edge of Night, and like I said, for whatever reason, I'm not really sure why, I was just thinking about death and the importance of death in the cycle of life a lot at the end of that book. And it's probably because The Ragged Edge of Night is set in World War II Germany, which is just the most depressing thing in the world to research. I mean, it was awful. I got so depressed while working on that book because I just had to constantly read about like Nazi atrocities and stuff. You know, it was horrible, horrible stuff. So that's probably why death was on my mind so much at that point. I think I needed to kind of cleanse my palate a little bit and make some sense out of all the death I had to read about. As much as you can make sense of something like the Holocaust and war, but I needed to find another way of thinking about and relating to death in order to save my own sanity. I think the reason why I connected that idea of death with the story of my grandparents' family, or my great grandparents' family, is probably when I really like get psychological about it and dig into my brain. It's probably because when I was a child, my two great grandparents, those were the first deaths I ever experienced, other than like, you know, the deaths of family pets. And I was close with them both. I visited them quite often. I was really lucky to have a good relationship with my great grandparents. So when they both died, just, you know, a few years apart, it made a big impact on me as a young person. So that's probably why I made that connection between Clyde and Beulah and the idea of death. So, yeah.
One interesting thing that happens when you start, you know, when you have an idea for a story and then you get down to the actual writing, is you learn more about these characters, and sometimes we learn more about ourselves in exploring these characters. Did you come away from this project at the end feeling like you had a deeper connection to this family that you'd heard about and that you had some connection with? And do you feel differently about that story at the end of this?
I wouldn't say, I mean, I fictionalized a lot of it. It was very loosely based on my family's story. And in particular, I really changed the nature of Beulah from the person she really was to serve sort of the fictional or archetypal purpose I needed her to serve in this book. So I don't feel differently about the family history or about the real relatives. But I feel like I have a greater understanding, I think, of the hardships that people faced back then and what it must have been like to live in that situation. Because really, like, having to dig way in and research, you know, how would you have taken care of sheep back then? What would you have done if your sheep got, like, fly strike, you know, which is a really common and serious disease among sheep? How would you treat it back then? Like, it's so different from modern times. I had to, like, dig way in and just go down all these crazy rabbit holes of what people did just to survive back then in that time and place. And then to, like, take additional elements out of that, like, you know, if they had to go get tar from the nearest town, which is 20 miles away, how would they do that without any, like, grown able-bodied men to help with that? You know, how would women and, like, little kids manage to get the supplies they needed? It was fascinating and wonderful, and it really gave me more of an appreciation of what my my particular ancestors must have actually faced when they were like, well, crap, here we are without our men. I guess it's just us ladies and our little kids now. and how daunting that must have been. It was really like almost scary at times to figure out, like, oh my God, how would they have gotten firewood? Oh, what would they have done if a flash flood came? It was just like, oh, it was terrifying. The frontier is terrifying, y'all.
Yes, it is. How did you, in the planning of this book, how did you decide on the narrative thread and the distance covered in this book? Were there things that you chose on purpose that this would be the beginning and this is where they were going to end? How do you start, you know, when you've got this big window, how do you nail down that this is the story I'm going to tell?
How I typically do it with most books is I get a clear, once I have a real clear picture in my head of the very last scene of the book, like once I can kind of see the last scene playing out like a movie, then I know I can get to that scene. So even if it's a book that I happen to be pantsing instead of plotting, which I do pants a few of them, as long as I know what the ending looks like, I will get there. I can assure myself that I'll get there. Blackbird was really different for me because it's a long book, as you experienced. I think it ended up being about like 170,000 words after all the final edits. It's almost the longest book I've written so far. But I never planned a single moment or line or scene of this book. I had no idea what the ending was going to be until I got there. And unusually for me, with my writing, every time I sat down to work on this book, it flowed like magic. I never had a single day where I was like, God, I hate this book and I want to destroy it, which is like almost every book I write. I'm like, oh my God, I hate you so much by like the, I don't know, 50% mark. I hate the book furiously. I think it sucks and I never want to look at it again, but I still have to write like half of it. So I have to. But Blackbird was totally different in that respect. It just came out of me, and I don't know where it came from. it just happened. So I wish I had a better answer that was, again, that's more useful for other authors listening to this. I'm usually, if I know that final scene, I can get myself there one way or another. But Blackbird just kind of wrote itself. It was weird.
Well, I think that's a great point that you bring up, that sometimes, and this was not your experience with this book, but that sometimes the writing is not perfect. It doesn't flow.
Yeah.
And it is hard work. You know, we think that it's all just fairies and magic dust, you know, around our writing desk. And sometimes it's just pounding out the keys and just thinking that everything is crap. And, you know, this is never going to be anything until one day the magic moment happens and it all coalesces and it becomes a thing. But when you are dealing with those feelings of inadequacy and the feelings of, you know, this is not working and all of that, are there things that you have learned through your illustrious writing career that help you get through those times?
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked that question as a follow-up to what I just said, because let me preface this by saying, even though Blackbird just kind of seemed to write itself and it was a wonderful, magical experience and it was great, it was the 35th book I've written under my various pen names over many years, and it's the only time that has ever happened. Every other book I've ever written has at least once, at some point, been absolute freaking torture to drag out of myself. So it just, you know, it didn't want to cooperate. I would have to backtrack and start over. I would just hate it all of a sudden, even though I knew the story was solid because I outlined it. I would just be like, I hate this book and I want to kill it. So if you're out there listening to this, please don't feel discouraged by what I just said about how this book kind of wrote itself, because that's the first time it's happened in 35 books. And I will also say I paid a heavy price for that. Because I spent the next 2 years after I actually wrote the manuscript for Blackbird not wanting to write anything. I never had a single day from that point until just about a week ago. Thank goodness the curse finally lifted. I never had a single day where I felt any joy for writing. I was just like, oh my God, I got it back to the grind. And I wrote two books during that time. One is Calamity, which the few people who have read it have been like, oh my God, this is incredible. I love it. So it turned out well. The other one's a manuscript I did for my publisher. It's going to come out in 2021. But I wrote two books during those 2 years where I didn't want to write anything. And like, people who've heard me talk on podcasts before know that I'm usually a much faster writer than that. I usually do about one book every 3 to 4 months. So Blackbird took something out of me, and then it never came back. And I was afraid I would never get it back. And then just the other day, thank goodness, while I was lying in bed, under the influence of some herbal medicine, shall we say, listening to David Bowie, it just like a bolt out of nowhere. I literally sat up rigidly in bed and was like, ah! And my husband was like, what's the matter? Are you okay? I was like, yeah, I just got a book in my head. I was like frantically scribbling down notes, and like an entire book came to me like all at once, and I actually wanted to write it. I was so excited to write it. So I was like, oh my God, it's back. Thank God. So
Like Ziggy Stardust crashing in your midst.
Ziggy came to me. So how do I get through those dark times? I just keep going. I keep going. I can't remember who said this, and I feel so badly about this now because it's such a cogent and important quote. Maybe you can look this up and cite this in your show notes. But the line is basically, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, craft is what sustains you when art fails you. So when you don't feel that inspiration to write, when it's not just coming to you like magic or just pouring out of you like Blackbird did, you still just go to your keyboard every day and you put in the work anyway, like even though it sucks. And listen, I know I've been there with many, many other books. I was there for 2 straight years recently where I didn't want to write a single word, but I did it anyway. I mean, mainly because this is how I pay all my bills. So if I stopped writing, I would be screwed. But also because I believed that it would come back. And it did, eventually. It took a long time. I was starting to feel like I was crazy for believing it at all. But I kept telling myself, if I just keep working and keep doing my job, the inspiration will come back to me. And happily it did. I think that's really how you do it. Like, you just show up and you do the work, even when you really don't feel like it. Because it's important to keep your craft honed. It really will. It'll save your butt when the art abandons you.
Love it. I love it. How are you splitting your time these days between Libby and Olivia and your indie published stuff and your trad stuff? Do you have a big calendar and a schedule you're working on, or are you just fitting things together? Like, what does that part of your professional life look like?
Boy, that's a great question. I don't know right now, because I went through this awful 2-year dry spell where I just didn't want to write anything. And it took me, you know, a year each to write two books. I mean, if I had had kind of the wind in my sails during those 2 years, I think it would have looked a lot differently. But I got one Libby Hawker book out and I got one done for my publisher. And that was kind of all I could manage. I've been very fortunate in that The Ragged Edge of Night is still a top seller. It just sold like gangbusters when it first came out. Its first year was absolutely phenomenal, which is great. And I've been able to just kind of live off of the royalties from that book while I floundered around forgetting everything I ever learned about writing novels. So I've been okay. I've been staying afloat, which is great. But I'm feeling really glad that now all the writing mojo seems to be back. And I'm actually kind of looking forward to seeing how I will split the time between Olivia and Libby. I think the plan right now, I have a manuscript, I have some edits I need to finish up for my publisher, and I also want to write a complete manuscript for my next book, the one that Ziggy Stardust gave me. I want to get that one written completely and then turned into them as a proposal. Usually I just sell them a book on proposal, but this one's so unusual and different that I think they need to read the whole book to get it. So I'm going to get those edits finished, get that manuscript finished and sent off. And then I think I'm just going to spend a whole bunch of time writing like fun commercial fiction, which I'm going to self-publish as Libby Hawker, just to kind of clear the cobwebs out of my brain, get back on that wagon, and kind of reacquaint myself with the commercial side of the industry. It's been a little while since I've been there, so I need to go back. Stay later.
I love that you're so honest about the last couple of years and the struggle you went through. You know, especially when we talk with a lot of very successful indie authors. You know, there's this idea of writing quickly, publishing often, and you know, we're professionals. You show up, you do the work, and you keep it cranking. And sometimes it just doesn't. It doesn't work that way. And, thank you for being honest about that because, you know, we all go through kind of ebbs and flows of the creative life.
Yeah, we do. And it's important to acknowledge that. And it's important to talk about it, I think, and be honest with it so that other people know that when it hits them, it's normal. It's not, you're not a weirdo. You're not a freak because this happened to you and it doesn't seem to be happening to anybody else. It happens to all the other writers sooner or later. And if it hasn't happened to him yet, it's coming, honey. So
that's right. That's right.
We all hit burnout or, you know, whatever that was. I don't know if it was burnout or if I like burned too bright for a little while on Blackbird and my brain just needed to recuperate. But, yeah, it happens. You know, it's a thing that comes along. So be wise with your financial planning, have some money put away so that if you have a few months or a couple of years or whatever, where you just can't make it work like you used to, that you can still be comfortable and safe and you're not going to lose your house or whatever. But yeah, when you do hit those crappy dry spells, it's going to come back sooner or later. It'll come back. Like if it came back for me, it'll come back for you too.
That's right. Well, the new book is called One for the Blackbird, One for the Crow, an absolutely stunning novel. I love this book so much. Libby / Olivia, if folks are just learning about you, and I'm going to put links to a bunch of your work in the show notes. We've kind of referenced several things here, make it easy for people to find you on Amazon. But if they want to dig into, you know, all the stuff that you do, is there a place on the internet that they can connect with you?
Yeah, you can find all my books and all the ways to contact me on my website, which is hawkerbooks.com.
Excellent. We'll put a link to it, as well as the link to the new book and all the stuff that you do in the show notes of this episode. Libby, thanks so much for joining me again on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me again. It was great to talk to you.
And we'll cut it right there. That was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. It was fun.
Yeah. I think we're going to release the show Monday or Tuesday of next week. So when we do, I'll be sure to send you a link and we'll blast it out everywhere.
Awesome. We will. We will indeed.
All right. Thank you so much, Libby.
Talk to you
soon. Have a great day.
You too.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
The brutes of the Andersonville Prison Hospital have moved me to the dead room, or so it has come to be known. None so domiciled have yet left this place. We receive only the smallest rations and only cursory care to reduce our odors and spare the nostrils of our keepers. The good Christians of the Confederacy do not see any need to provide comfort to those who will soon sleep soundly enough underground. You must know, at least, how your father came to such an end. At Doctortown, Kilpatrick entrusted me with the conquest of a railroad trestle, and my bummers, my demolition team, acquitted themselves admirably, thanks to my ingenuity with powder. We successfully destroyed the trestle work past Morgan's Lake. This would prove to be my entire contribution to the war. Federal troops were unable to capture the bridge or overcome the enemy's battery. Kilpatrick withdrew, and my bummers and I found ourselves on the wrong side of the Altamaha River, behind the enemy line with no hope of reaching our encampment. Rebels accosted us, taking our remaining supplies. We escaped and headed south, hoping by a long march to reach Seymour's forces in Jacksonville, but we encountered other rebel encampments at Jessup. 4 of my men were lost to gunfire. We marched west, then south again, barely evading capture. We had no choice but to brave the great swamp Okefenokee. Oh, on and on it goes, in every direction, endlessly. We trudged through miles of grasping mud and noxious rot, pursued by hunger and the mosquito, scratching at our arms and faces until all our skin was scourged. We lived off alligator meat at first, then nothing at all. My men grew mutinous, blamed me for all their misfortunes, threatened to throw me in a sack, weigh me down with stones, and sink my body. Yet was I not equally hungry? Did I not starve? I grew weary of their endless insubordination and contempt. Finally, they took hold of me and swore they would hang me by the neck for leading them to ruin. They were 5 in number, younger than I and more muscular. I was no match for them physically. They laid their hands on me and I burned them. I burned those men. The flame rose from me as from a volcano, stripping the skin from those boys, blackening their faces, roasting their flesh. And let this be my final ghastly confession. I feasted that night, feasted on the meat of my prospective murderers. And that is how I survived. I staggered alone from that swamp, a mad thing, fueled by outrage and guilt. I saw an encampment of rebel soldiers and surrendered myself gladly. They say in Andersonville prison all men are brothers, equal in filth, equal in terror, equal in ruin. Yet I feel I may claim some small distinction, at least, for I am surely damned to a greater extent than any here.